Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, Cuba and Commerce After Castro. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Fidel Castro is dead. And this morning, the first regularly scheduled American Airlines passenger flight took off from Miami International Airport en route to Jose Marti International Airport in Havana, first time since 1961. That was the same year the U.S. severed diplomatic relations with Cuba. The legislative groundwork was approved that led to the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba, and the failed Bay of Pigs invasion was launched. Castro's death on Friday was announced by his brother and hand-chosen president of Cuba, Raúl.
Falleció el comandante en jefe de la Revolución Cubana, Fidel Castro Ruz.
It was 8 months ago that President Barack Obama made his historic trip to Havana, and while President Obama did not meet Fidel, he might as well have been directing these words to the last living leader linked to the economic and military standoffs of the 20th century.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
Fidel may be dead, but the Castro regime lives on, and despite the small reforms Raúl Castro has undertaken during his presidency, they have been forced by the economic realities on the island. And the rapprochement between America and Cuba faces new political realities here in the United States. On Saturday, Cuban-American Republican representatives from South Florida's congressional delegation voiced hope that President-elect Donald Trump will increase pressure on the Castro regime. Now, Trump has called the renewed diplomatic relations and easing of economic restrictions on Americans a, quote, bad deal. This is Republican Representative Carlos Curbelo on Saturday.
Our position is the same. We want to do everything we can to strengthen the Cuban people and to weaken the dictatorship.
Representative Curbelo represents Florida's 26th congressional district, the southernmost in the continental United States. He joins us now here on the Sunshine Economy. Welcome back, Representative. Nice to hear from you. Representative, is the dictatorship weakened by Fidel Castro's death on Friday night?
There's no question. Look, Tom, there's not going to be an immediate change in Cuba. We're going to see the status quo, at least for the coming weeks and months. But the figure of Fidel Castro was a heavy psychological burden on the Cuban people, the most imposing figure in the modern history of that country. And the fact that he is no longer in Cuba, no longer on the face of the earth, certainly opens the door, makes it more likely that there can be a true change in Cuba toward a freer, more democratic, and more open society.
Is the dictatorship weakened by such opening of relations represented by the American Airlines flight that took off today from Miami International Airport to Havana?
I don't think so. We've had people-to-people contact for many years. We've had Cuban Americans traveling for decades now to visit their family members, support their family members, and I'm fine with all of that. Our goal is not to hurt the Cuban people. It's to strengthen the Cuban people, and specifically to support the opposition leaders, those who are trying to build a civil society in Cuba and open up some alternatives to the Castro regime. We believe that one of the most effective ways of helping those elements and of helping the Cuban people is to weaken the oppressive government. A totalitarian government does not change because it likes to or it wants to. It changes because it's forced to.
Do the flights such as those that took off today and that will continue to take off, the cruise ships that go from Port Miami into Port of Havana and elsewhere, do those help weaken that totalitarian regime?
To the extent that they have over the last few decades, maybe. Again, we have had flights to Cuba for a long time. Before, they were charter flights flown by American Airlines. Now they are American Airlines planes flown by American Airlines.
Yeah.
So the change has been somewhat immaterial. I think people talk a lot about it, but really there's no significant change in the number of people, specifically Cuban Americans, that are visiting Cuba.
Well,
and I do think, Tom, and I want to make it very clear, I don't want to limit in any way Cuban Americans visiting their family members. I do think that helps.
What about efforts of other Americans to visit Cuba under the 12 designations that are currently allowable by the U.S. government?
Well, under U.S. law, and of course the Obama administration has signed executive orders that we believe are unconstitutional, or at least in violation of U.S. law, specifically the Helms-Burton Act of 1996. Under that law, tourism to Cuba is illegal.
Right.
And the Obama administration has really made a sham out of the licenses, because pretty much anyone can get a license, and it's just an administrative burden now. So what we would like is for the next administration to follow the law.
So that would mean going back on the easing of the travel restrictions, for instance, that we've seen over the past 2 years.
Well, what we'd like to do is, you know, travel restrictions are fine, you know, specifically for Cuban Americans, people-to-people contacts, those Americans who are going to Cuba for a specific purpose, religious, education, cultural. That is what the law allows. The law does not allow tourism to Cuba, and that's what we're seeing now. And anyway, any debate about this should take place in the Congress of the United States. No president, Republican or Democrat, has the power to make laws. And we have seen that President Obama, at the very least, has come very close to making a law when it comes to Cuba policy, and that's just wrong. That's not how our country works.
President-elect Donald Trump released a statement on Saturday after Fidel Castro's death that read in part, quote, "Our administration will do all it can to ensure the Cuban people can finally begin their journey toward prosperity and liberty." Representative Curbelo, does that journey include the current trade embargo?
I certainly believe that the incoming administration has no plans to call for the lifting of the trade embargo. The president-elect, during his campaign, made clear that he wanted to see political prisoners freed, basic human rights restored. That's what the Helms-Burton law says. It lays out very specific conditions for the normalization of relations,
including a change of government in Cuba.
That's right. And that's the commitment he made. Now, obviously, it's up to him and his administration what they're going to do with regards to the executive orders and what they're going to encourage Congress to do. But what I can assure you is that we're going to see an end to this policy of unilateral concession after unilateral concession to the Cuban regime, a regime that is still an enemy. The United States still has one of the most sophisticated spy networks in our country, still works to undermine our interests all over the world, especially here in Latin America. Just look at what they're doing in Venezuela. So I do think that this administration does walk into the White House with clear eyes about who Raul Castro is and what the Cuban regime represents.
Representative Carlos Curbelo along with us here on the Sunshine Economy. Representative, let me ask you about one of your Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill, Senator Marco Rubio. He was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, and he described the goal of America's Cuban policy this way.
Our goal is not to punish. Our goal is to figure out what can we do through U.S. policy to, number one, look out for the national interest of the United States, and number two, to help create an environment where we are creating the potential for a transition to a democratic order in Cuba at some point in the near future.
So I want to ask you, Representative Curbelo, about creating that environment for the potential for a transition to a democratic order in Cuba. Do any of the policy changes made during the Obama administration, reducing the travel restrictions, allowing more imports and exports to come in and out of the United States, easing of the financial and banking restrictions, do any of these, in your estimation, Representative, create the potential for that transition to a democratic order?
I think that lifting of the restrictions on Cuban Americans helping their family members, visiting their family members, I think those are positive, and those were done early in the administration. Most of the policy changes after December of 2014 have really exclusively assisted the Cuban government. And Senator Rubio's exactly right. If we're going to create an environment where there can be a true change in Cuba, the kind of positive change that we'd like to see for the Cuban people and for U.S.-Cuba relations, the Cuban totalitarian government has to be weakened. The stronger that government gets, the more likely it is that it will be able to survive the death of the other dictator who's in power today, Raul Castro. And that is the goal of the Castro regime. They did not engage the United States because they wanted to have a good relationship. They didn't engage because they wanted to change. They engaged because they needed a lifeline. They need money. They need resources to strengthen their grip on power and to make that passing off the baton from one generation of Castros to the next generation of Castros smoother and easier. The Obama administration is betting on stability for the future of Cuba. We know that that stability includes torture, repression, violation of human rights. That's not what we want for the future.
You're saying
of
the
Cuba.
Obama administration is betting on stability of the current regime in Cuba?
That's right. That's right. And that's why President Obama met not only with Raul Castro, but also with Raul Castro's son and Raul Castro's grandson, in a way, at least implicitly endorsing this family dynasty, this military dictatorship in Cuba. And that is what we oppose. I don't know why anyone would wish for the Cuban people a continuation of the status quo.
If President-elect Trump comes to you for counsel on Cuba, has he done that, by the way, Representative Curbelo?
No, I okay. have been in touch with the transition, but not specifically with the president.
If he does that, he has run on a campaign as a deal maker among many different things, and he has talked about the current dealings with Cuba as a bad deal. Would you counsel President-elect Trump to meet with any leadership of the Cuban government, the current Cuban regime?
I don't think that a meeting with Raul Castro would in any way be productive. The Cuban regime seeks out these opportunities to get their dictator together with the Pope and with other world leaders. Why? Because it gives them legitimacy in the eyes of the international community, and legitimacy is good for business. So I think that any engagement with the Cuban regime should include preconditions. And the Cuban regime should understand that the United States, number one, is going to defend its laws. We have the Libertad Act, the Helms-Burton Act, which is the law of the land. It was signed by President Clinton in 1996. This is a law that the Obama administration refused to defend at the United Nations when Cuba and other enemies of the United States sponsored a resolution condemning our country. We're not going to see any of that anymore. I'm sure that the next administration is going to defend our laws and that any engagement with Cuba will have preconditions.
Representative Curbelo, our time is tight here. Let me just ask you about one other piece of legislation regarding Cubans, a piece of legislation that you introduced last year that would require Cuban immigrants to file refugee and asylum claims instead of being essentially being considered for one automatically. And this would involve potentially the denial of government benefits like food stamps, Medicaid, and even Social Security. I'm going to play just a quick soundbite of you talking about how you introduced this bill and a little bit of your explanation of the reasons behind it.
Like asylum seekers from all over the world, those Cubans seeking public assistance benefits will have to demonstrate that they left Cuba fleeing political persecution and are unable to return under the current totalitarian regime.
Now, I know the legislation is still pending. It's in committee in the House. And, of course, we're coming up to a new Congress and whether or not you'll reintroduce this. Would you reintroduce this in the new Congress, by the way?
I'm certainly going to reintroduce it. And, by the way, Tom, it has 128 co-sponsors, Republicans and Democrats. Our migration policy towards Cuba is broken. It is neither good for the United States nor is it good for the future of Cuba. As long as the best option for every Cuban is to come to the United States, there's not going to be a change in that country. And obviously, irregular immigration patterns are challenging to our government, and specifically to local government. So we do need to change this equation.
So how would tightening the rules on American government benefits for Cubans coming here work to achieve that goal of a democratic order in Cuba?
Well, number one, it would prevent a lot of the abuse that we see of our country's generosity. We have some Cubans that come to the United States, qualify to receive benefits, then move back to Cuba and continue receiving those benefits. We have people who arrive in the United States over the age of 65 and get Social Right. Security for life just because they are Cuban. This is a policy that's incoherent. It's broken. It encourages people, really, or it discourages people from taking ownership of their society in Cuba. And by the way, it also discourages people from taking ownership of their society here in the United States. When you have people who come here, who claim asylum, they receive it automatically and then get these benefits and take the money back to Cuba. That is just wrong. It's disrespectful of U.S. taxpayers. It really mocks American generosity, and it can't stand.
Representative Carlos Curbelo, along with us here on the Sunshine Economy. Representative, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. You all have a great day.
Still to come on our program, the future of the Cuban economy and South Florida's role in it. That's next as the program continues. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. When President Obama visited Havana last spring, he had already eased up on travel restrictions, some American export rules, and a few banking regulations. Now, the travel and trade changes get a heck of a lot of attention, especially the lifting of limits on bringing back Cuban rum and cigars. But it's the banking rules that may well determine the economic fate of any normalization between the two countries in the years ahead. Cash and credit is the lifeblood of international economic relations. Cubans in Cuba can now open bank accounts in the United States. American banks are now allowed to process business deals involving Cuba if they are done in U.S. dollars. South Florida is home to international banking for the Caribbean and Latin America. If there is financial activity to be had between the United States and Cuba, it would be through South Florida, right? Well, we'll see. Juan Del Busto is along with us, former executive with the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve. He is also an entrepreneur himself. On telephone from the Dominican Republic is Carlos Saldrigas. He is the chairman of the Cuba Study Group. And Mimi Whitefield is along with us with our partner, the Miami Herald. She is the Cuba and International Business Correspondent. Carlos, let me begin with you. How have the new banking regulations between the United States and Cuba played any role in financial activity seen through the international finance business here in Florida?
In my opinion, Tom, is still very limited, but it is clearly aimed at helping the small entrepreneurs in Cuba that are doing business over there. For instance, an entrepreneur can bring some cash here from the money and the profits that they're making in Cuba. They can put it in a bank account here. They can buy some goods and supplies that then they will put in a suitcase and take back to Cuba for their own businesses. Or they can simply put away some of the savings here for buying capital equipment and other things a little bit later down the road. The whole purpose of that regulation was aimed at helping the small entrepreneur on the island have access and be able to put a bank account here. I know of a few cases where these small entrepreneurs have actually sold their merchandise here in the States. I know of two cases. One is a lady, a gentleman that makes bikinis, mm-hmm. and he's been able to sell some of them here. And another one is a lady that makes, handcrafted soaps and other products and has been able to do several transactions here and been able to having an account facilitates that process. It's also good for ordinary Cubans who can now have an account here and put their money in a safe place as opposed to keeping some of the savings in a Cuban bank.
Juan Del Busto, let me ask you, as a former banking regulator with the Federal Reserve, you're no longer with the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve, we'll point that out, but a number of banks have looked at the potential for business with Cuba and Cubans as a real gray area after so many years of very firm regulations not to do it. Have the banks at all embraced this potential?
I think they're waiting and seeing what's happening with Stonegate Bank, which was the first bank there. However, what Carlos says works very well, but I'm looking at it from the opposite aspect. If a Cuban wants to buy a tractor, if a Cuban wants to buy a container full of materials, how is that company here going to get paid? And it has to be immediate funds, because I would not trust the regulatory environment so far as banking is concerned in Cuba. So you need to work on the other side to make sure the institutions in Cuba are ready to support the shipments of goods going there. I think initially, with Castro's death, nothing is going to change on that front. But I'm a member of Cuban Banking Study Group. It was formed by Fernando Capablanca in the 90s. And now there was a conference already in Cuba in July with the Cuban banking regulators, the American banking regulators. OFAC sent 8 individuals there.
OFAC is the regulatory body here in the United States regarding
So that process is moving. in March of the coming year, that same conference is going to be held in Washington. So movement along those lines is progressing.
Mimi Whitefield, let me ask you, to Carlos's point that these banking regulations have been directed at the Quinto Propistas, the small businesses, to the concerns voiced by Juan del Busto, what's your experience of on the ground in Cuba of those Quinto Propistas and their knowledge, if not their simple financial ability to be able to engage more with the United States?
Well, many of these businesses started out very small, maybe mom and pop, one or two employees. I've met with some of them that now have 40, 50 employees. They're quite sophisticated. They're eager to engage with the United States to get U.S. imports, especially some of the little businesses that renovate cars would love to get those old auto parts. Right now, what we have is kind of a suitcase commerce. Many of the Cuban Americans who travel to the island take the things that their relatives and friends need for their businesses in their accompanying baggage. That's really not the way to encourage business. And under the Obama administration, there have been an opening toward these Quinto Propistas that would permit more regular commerce, but it takes two sides, and the Cubans haven't really come up with corresponding rules and institutions that would allow this to take place.
Carlos addressed that that nature of this. That's what we've heard, the general criticism, what we just heard from Representative Curbelo here on the program, but from others, that there hasn't been a quid pro quo of easing of regulations on the island, let alone the civil liberties and the political liberties, but in terms of the economic sanctions that the Cuban economic system puts on their own people, we haven't seen an easing of that.
You are asking me, Tom?
Yes, Carlos. Yeah. Yeah.
I fully agree, and this is why I find it amazing that in the face that is so obvious that the Cuban government is not interested in dollars flowing in, why are we talking about going back to history and tightening sanctions? You know, this is a government that believes that economic activity actually hurts their controlling power. And therefore, having had the opportunity to match all of Obama's regulation and with the possibility of opening the door to a flow of foreign exchange into Cuba on a wider basis than they're having today, they have refused to do it. Now, that brings it along with the death of Fidel Castro, whom I believe has been the epicenter of the socialist orthodoxy in Cuba. And perhaps with his death, the reformers in the system, and there are many, will begin to gain the upper hand, and we may see that process accelerate now that Fidel Castro is no longer around to say no to many things that may have been proposed before. This became very evident to observers during the last Congress of the Communist Party. You know, the way the whole thing built up is crescendo, and then the way it crashed in terms of expectations.
Yeah,
it was clearly an indication that Fidel got hold of the issues and killed him.
You're referring to the Communist Congress in April.
There
were a lot of expectations after President Obama's visit in March that there would be further economic reforms introduced, but in fact, none of that was the case. Juan del Busto, with the former official with the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve, what do we know about the Cuban banking system? Is it in any shape at all to engage with the American system at this point?
They can react quickly.
Cuba can.
Cuba can, but like Carlos said, the unwillingness has not. I would have figured that would have been the first thing they would have concentrated on. And we were willing to help from the U.S. To help the Cuban people, and they have not moved as quickly.
Or at all, as the critics would say.
Well, some individuals in the Cuban banking system were moving more quickly, but they were stopped for how quickly they were moving. Mm. Who stopped them, we don't know. But I think the biggest change is going to be Donald Trump,
right?
What he does.
Right.
So I think before any other financial institution moves into Cuba, they're going to see what he does.
Mimi Whitefield, it's still a hard currency economy in Cuba. You've traveled extensively there. I was there in March during the president's visit. As tourists are coming to visitors are coming to coming to experience, it's not a place where you travel on credit.
No, it's not. In fact, the only U.S. credit card that's accepted in Cuba right now is issued by Stonegate Bank. There's also a Puerto Rican bank that supports credit cards in Cuba. None of the other banks have touched it. And there also are very limited ATMs. Yeah. And in terms of paying with your credit card, you're only going to be able to do that at a limited number of state-run hotels, mm-hmm. restaurants.
To the trio here, stay with us here. We've got a break, but coming up, I want to talk about whether or not there's business to be had in Cuba after Castro's death and a waiting for the Donald Trump administration here in the United States. That's still to come next on the Sunshine Economy. We're back on the Sunshine Economy, Cuba and Commerce After Castro, talking with Carlos Saladrigas, chairman of the Cuba Study Group, Juan Del Busto, former regional executive of the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve, and Mimi Whitefield, Cuba and business correspondent for our partner, the Miami Herald. Carlos, our final moments here with you. Describe the economic conditions on the island today.
Well, they're disastrous. It's an economy that is absolutely not productive. It is not growing its GDP at anywhere near the rate it needs to grow. There is a tremendous lack of investment, capital investment. But on the other hand, and it's completely tied down by bureaucracy. It's obtuse. It's incredibly difficult to break through. This is why it is so difficult to reform.
Yeah.
Because you have to unwind so many parts and so many pieces to make something happen. That is incredibly challenging and difficult for anybody to do that.
Mimi, have the conditions at all changed on the island since the normalization began almost 2 years ago?
I think the most tangible evidence is in the tourism sector. There are many more American travelers, actually many more travelers from other countries around the world. And the tourism industry is where private entrepreneurs engaged more than any other sector Cuban economy.
Let me ask you, if Donald Trump cancels normalization, what's the economic impact for the island?
I think we need to wait and see. I think if tourism is curtailed, that's their major economic process. Also, we try to study the GDP of Cuba, and it's really hard to get a handle what's true economic development and what is their true GDP. So we haven't been able to analyze what the true GDP is.
To all three of you, thank you for your thoughts here today. Still to come as the program continues, whatever a Trump administration may do with Cuba, how it may make its case to the international community. That's next. The program continues. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. When President-elect Trump is sworn into office in January, his choice to lead America's efforts with the United Nations is South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She has to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. If that happens, she may be playing a leading role in how a Trump administration engages with Cuba, at least explains its actions to its economic allies around the globe. Thomas Pickering knows that job well. He was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President George Herbert Walker Bush.
The Trump administration has an opportunity either to go back to the bad old days and what I would call stalemate and worse, or to see whether, in fact, the new direction, which has been a very slow direction and it's been an up and down direction, will in effect pick up a little speed or return. But in some ways, it's a mutual test. It's a test of whether, in fact, the disappearance of Fidel will produce more forward movement under Raul and whoever his successor might be, or whether, in fact, our policies, which at the moment, I think, are best attuned to bringing about the change in Cuba we'd like to see are continued, or we go back to a hardline and opposed policy.
As a former ambassador, someone who is certainly attuned to the diplomacy involved here, what are some of those changes that you would advise the Trump administration and even its new proposed leadership of the United Nations perhaps consider at this time in history and this time in the engagement between the U.S. and Cuba?
Yes, I think the changes are not to roll back the gradual opening of Cuba to American visitors. Cuba had, I think, 5 million tourists there last year. And that person-to-person contact and indeed the ability of people to go and talk and see talk and see Cubans and see what's happening, while limited in some cases by the way in which it's been organized, is nevertheless, I think, a step forward from the old days where, in fact, we held back. I think the ability to increase the amount of remittance money that Cubans can send to their families, Cuban Americans can send to their families and to others, is an important aspect of moving the question ahead. I would like to see us open the door to more Cuban students coming to the United States who would like to. That might require scholarships. We should think about that. We had a Fulbright program around the world that never touched Cuba. Maybe that could be a useful way to proceed in that regard. So there are many, I think, thoughtful and useful ideas. They're not revolutionary, but they're evolutionary.
The president-elect has called the deal a bad deal for America. And in fact, the Cuban-American congressional leadership delegation here in South Florida have said frequently that the United States has not extracted more freedoms or more easing of economic restrictions from Cuba itself. Do you see it as a quid pro quo kind of negotiation, kind of diplomacy that needs to happen here?
Well, I have the greatest respect for the Cuban-American community. It's a community that has its own different views, and I've heard many from all particular sides. My sense is that a better deal would be further negotiations with Cuba to open things up in response for more opportunities for economic investment and things of that sort. And that would be, I think, a win-win on both sides. It's never a perfect deal. We got some 50 Cuban dissidents out of jail. We had an American who'd been held there for a long period of time. I visited him there 2 years ago. And another American we hadn't heard about, who were released in return for three Cubans who were in jail here for spying, who were released. That's part and parcel of what are traditional Cold War-type settlements, where the human element takes first priority in our regard. And I think that's important, but I think there are opportunities to go further in the same direction, I think, to reverse direction, which has also been implied by some of the statements that that Mr. Trump made when he was a candidate. Would be a mistake. I think the question, he's a deal maker. The question is, okay, what's the next step in the deal and how can it be improved?
Senator Rubio, for instance, has pointed to how the United States has negotiated with Myanmar, the former Burma, and provided some openings to that country in exchange for more domestic policy changes. He has said that could be a model for Cuba. Do you agree?
I think so. Myanmar is a different country in some way. Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi was a leader of the country, a longtime dissident under house arrest for a long period of time, someone who commands international respect. Unfortunately, the Cuban system has suppressed or in whatever way it can eliminated or reduced the capacity of that kind of leadership. We need to look for that kind of leadership in Cuba, and hopefully it will come. There are things that one can do, and I have very great respect for Senator Rubio and his thoughts about that, because I think they are constructive and point in the right direction, and hopefully the president-elect will look at those.
The former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Thomas Pickering. Still to come, two entrepreneurs in exile working to return to Cuba. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Cuba and Commerce After Castro. I'm Tom Hudson. In 1992, Ubaldo Huerta left his native Cuba. It was the beginning of what would become known as the special period, one of those Orwellian phrases that belittles the suffering on the island. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, it stopped sending billions of dollars of aid to Cuba, and the island's economy went into a freefall. Ubaldo left after studying computer engineering with no computer. Once outside Cuba, he founded a website in Barcelona that was kind of like Craigslist. eBay bought it in 2005. Aram Centellas went to the same schools as Ubaldo, just a decade and a half later. He also was studying computer engineering, but by then the computers were in the schools. They didn't have internet, though. Aram also founded his own website business that borrowed from the Craigslist concept. He did it inside Cuba at the time. However, in 2008, less than a year after starting his website, the Cuban government shut it down, so Aram left Cuba and also moved to Spain. These two entrepreneurs in exile are in business together now with a company called Fonoma. The service allows users to buy cell phone service time and Wi-Fi internet time for an existing cell phone number in Cuba. It's kind of a 21st century type of remittance. We spoke with them this morning from Spain.
Well, when I heard the news, I felt relief because I'm hoping to turn the page and start looking at Cuba's future and not be held basically hostage by the sort of influence that Fidel has had in my country for the last, 60 years. I was born in 1969, well into the Castro's government, and I'm ready to turn the page and move on. So I feel my sense of relief, basically.
Aram, how about you? When you first heard the news, you left Cuba in 2008. What were your thoughts of when you heard that Fidel Castro had finally died at 90 years old?
For me, it's like, since I was a child, I was hearing about the time of this news. People always were talking about when this happened, what gonna happen with Cuba, what gonna happen with us. When you live in Cuba, this scenario is like the coming of a new era. You see this event as the one that will change everything. And now I feel totally the opposite, because I feel like it has a lot of symbols for me, but when I heard about that, it was like, okay, that just happened. It has been happening since 10 years. So it's like Fidel was slowly dying from 10 years. So now I don't feel much difference. I'm not that impacted about that.
Some of the Cuban-American political leadership here in South Florida have voiced similar caution, Aram, saying that the dictator may be dead now, but the dictatorship lives on, meaning the Castro regime and, of course, all the policies and the economic policies continue. And it sounds like you're thinking along those same lines.
Yeah, I'm totally in the same line. In the short and medium term, nothing will change.
Ubaldo, let me ask you about any business impact. Fonoma, the business that you and Aram operate, allow folks outside of Cuba to buy cell phone time and Wi-Fi time for Cubans. Have you seen any change in the business even since Friday night, since the announcement of Fidel's death?
Well, we ran a promotion, a Black Friday promotion that was very successful. And the irony of this is Fidel died also on Black Friday. But we've seen an increase in traffic and more people buying actually, Wi-Fi time. But it's hard to tell whether it's related to the Black Friday promotion or whether it's related to Cubans wanting to communicate more with their relatives in Cuba, especially from the Wi-Fi hotspots, where they could get a sense of what's going on in the streets and whatnot.
It's been about 2 years since the normalization process has begun between the United States and Cuba. We've seen a certain economic easing of restrictions on Americans. Have you seen any impact on your business at Fonoma that you can attribute to the change in economic engagement or travel engagement between the United States and Cuba?
We did. We actually, our business improved tremendously. We had a new line of business. We sold the top-ups for the production company running the Fast and Furious sequel in Cuba. That was great business. We're in the process of trying to...
That was the movie that was shot in Havana recently.
That movie that was shot in Havana this year. And so, yeah, we had great business. So we also get a lot of demands, people saying that they want to travel to Cuba. They want to get a SIM card from a company and go pick up the SIM card in an office in Cuba. We're going to provide that. So we're in the process of launching that sort of product. No, we do. We do. We see a shift in the business from pure form of remittance or bill payment from Cuban exiles or Cuban immigrants trying to help the Cuban family, from that to visitors trying to go to the island. They want a SIM card. I want to have a, you know, be able to call inside the island, and also to American businesses that want to operate there. Although we have to, at the same time, we have to acknowledge that in the summertime, we see a lack of enthusiasm for American businesses, certainly to do business in Cuba.
What do you attribute that downturn in the summertime from?
I think the government, you know, signal to American businesses that, you know, after all this barrage of visitors trying to figure out, explore the business opportunities there, that nothing materialized, you know, they just, you know, I think American businesses want to see more indication that the reforms are just steps are more solid. And at the same time, now, after this surprise victory of Donald Trump, the uncertainty, I think, will be even more.
Does his death change any long-term planning that you may have for this business and for any potential return to Cuba for your business, Ubaldo?
I'm going to Cuba every couple months now. We have a small team of incredible programmers and designers that work with us. And my plan is to eventually relocate to Cuba, or at least live in Cuba part-time. I have to wait and see whether there is a climate of economic and political freedom that will let me, you know, live there. In the current situation, I cannot live there more than part-time. I don't feel totally welcome.
Aram, how about for you? Do you feel the same as Ubaldo? You'd like to go back, but you're looking for more of these civil liberties and economic freedoms?
Yes. Well, actually, I'm in the middle of that transition right now. Since 2014, I have to make a shift in my mindset. Like, see me like an expat instead of an immigrant.
You think of yourself more as an expatriate at this point, somebody on their way back to their homeland, as opposed to an immigrant, somebody who's going to stay in Spain, where you are today.
That was huge for me, yeah.
Yeah. Ubaldo, what are the signs that you will look for to give you the comfort to move back to your homeland full-time and perhaps operate your business there as well?
Well, I have to see a deepening of the economic reform. I have to see the legalization of, small businesses, a clear mechanism for small businesses to operate. So the signs, I guess, more open debate, you know, public opinion that, you know, that could represent more diverse views of Cubans and not just the view of the Cubans in the Communist Party. And those things will make me certainly more, you know, inclined to sort of try to have a sort of a permanent or part-time residence in Cuba. My mom lives in Cuba, and so I have a home in Cuba. But I have to see changes in both fronts. I mean, economic front alone, not enough. But But at the same time, I understand that economic reforms have to precede the other changes in the society.
Ubaldo Huerta and Aram Centellas, two exiled Cuban entrepreneurs on the death of Fidel Castro and their economic future back in their native home. Finally, on the Sunshine Economy, you remember that first regularly scheduled passenger commercial airplane that I mentioned at the first of the program? It was an American Airlines flight, took off from Miami International Airport today at 7:30 in the morning, landed an hour later at Jose Marti International Airport in Havana. WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett was on the plane. He's with us now from Havana. Tim, an uneventful flight logistic-wise. What about the ceremony?
Well, the ceremony was colorful at gate D30 at Miami International. There was a big red ribbon cutting ceremony, and the crew and the executives of American Airlines looked pretty exultant. I think, if anything else, just because they knew that they were now able to land in Havana and actually be able to get to a ramp rather than have to go through all the rigmarole that the airlines have to go through when they're doing charter flights to Cuba. And that was very much the case. It was a very smooth flight. But as I said, it was a big celebration by American. I think, you know, as American Miami Vice President Ralph Lopez Massa told me, he says this is very historic because it's really a good chance to connect what he calls the two capitals of Cuba, and they gave passengers their very own Cuban straw hats as they boarded the plane. But obviously, you know, there's a bit of clouds of uncertainty, let's say, you know, over this celebration, because the flight would be landing into a Cuba that's under 9 days of mourning because of the death of Fidel Castro Friday night, but also because back on the other side of the Florida Straits, there were a lot of remarks over the weekend by aides to President-elect Donald Trump that he does plan to cancel normalization of relations with Cuba once he takes office in January.
I know you haven't had a chance to really talk to many Cubans yet as you are still making your way, as we talk here today, on your way from Jose Marti to the airport. But those are well-traveled roads that you're familiar with. Do you sense any difference here traveling to Cuba for the first time since Fidel's death?
No, I really did not. I was expecting maybe, you know, to see black sashes and all sorts of other mourning accoutrements at the airport. There really wasn't any of that. There's obviously not, you know, salsa out on the streets, and we were told before we got here that, for example, I was on the flight with two gentlemen from California who were looking forward to watching baseball games here in Cuba this week, but they were informed back in Miami that they probably won't have a lot of baseball to watch here because that's one of the things that's been suspended, as well as other, you know, celebratory tourist items like music in Old Havana. That you and I remember from March. So, you know, there is that, but really I'm not noticing, anything different really as I make my way into the city.
The symbolism of the first commercial flight from Miami into Havana since 1961 is certainly historic, but then it coming just a matter of really 72 hours or so after the death of the architect of modern communist Cuba can't be lost in anybody either at this point, Tim.
No. And as I said, that's why I think, for example, there was supposed to be a big cocktail that American Airlines was going to host tonight here in Havana. That's been canceled. And so, yeah, there is that cloud, both of his death hanging over Cuba, but also that political uncertainty on both sides of the Florida Straits that makes, you know, the historic celebration of this first commercial flight between Miami and Havana a little more subdued as well.
Tim Padgett will be reporting from Cuba throughout the week on WLRN and WLRN.org. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.